and now her father would be making long, gentle speeches about what young ladies aren't supposed to do. There just wasn't anything they were supposed to do, it looked like, except choke and die, maybe. "Arcadia," said her father gently, "it strikes me that a young lady, she knew it, should not be quite so impertinent to men older than she is. Well, what did he want to come peeping around my window for? A young lady has a right to privacy. Now I'll have to do my whole darn composition over. It's not up to you to question his propriety in coming to your window. You should simply not have let him in. You should have called me instantly, especially if you thought I was expecting him." She said peevishly, "It's just as well if you didn't see him, stupid thing. He'll give the whole thing away if he keeps going to windows instead of doors." "Arcadia, nobody wants your opinion on matters you know nothing of." "I do, too. It's a second foundation, that's what it is." There was a silence. Even Arcadia felt a little nervous stirring in her abdomen. Dr. Darrell said softly, "Where have you heard this?" "Nowheres. But what else is there to be so secret about? You don't have to worry that I'll tell anyone." "Mr. Anthor," said Dr. Darrell, "I must apologize for all this." "Oh, that's all right," came Anthor's rather hollow response. "It's not your fault if she's sold herself to the forces of darkness. But do you mind if I ask her a question before we go? Miss Arcadia, what do you want? Why do you think it is stupid to go to windows instead of to doors?" "Because you advertise what you're trying to hide, silly. If I have a secret, I don't put tape over my mouth and let everyone know I have a secret. I talk just as much as usual, only about something else. Didn't you ever read any of the sayings of Salvor Hardin? He was our first mayor, you know." "Yes, I know." "Well, he used to say that only a lie that wasn't ashamed of itself could possibly succeed. He also said that nothing had to be true, but everything had to sound true. Well, when you come in through a window, it's a lie that's ashamed of itself and doesn't sound true." "Then what would you have done?" "If I'd wanted to see my father on top-secret business, I would have made his acquaintance openly and seen him about all sorts of strictly legitimate things. And then when everyone else knew all about you and connected you with my father as a matter of course, you could be as top-secret as you want, and nobody would ever think of questioning it." Anthor looked at the girl strangely, then at Dr. Darrell. He said, "Let's go. I have a briefcase I want to pick up in the garden." "Wait. Just one last question. Arcadia, you don't really have a baseball bat under your bed, do you?" "No, I don't." "Ha! I didn't think so." Dr. Darrell stopped at the door. "Arcadia," he said, "when you rewrite your composition on the Selden plan, don't be unnecessarily mysterious about your grandmother. There is no necessity to mention that part at all." He and Peleus descended the stairs in silence. Then the visitor asked in a strained voice, "Do you mind, sir, how old is she?" 14, day before yesterday." 14? Great galaxy. "Tell me, has she ever said she expects to marry someday?" "No, she hasn't. Not to me." "Well, if she ever does, shoot him. The one she's going to marry, I mean." He stared earnestly into the older man's eyes. "I'm serious. Life could hold no greater horror than living with what she'll be like when she's 20. I don't mean to offend you, of course." "You don't offend me. I think I know what you mean." Upstairs, the object of their tender analyses faced the transcriber with revolted weariness and said dully, "The future of Selden's plan." The transcriber, with infinite aplomb, translated that into elegantly complicated script capitals as, "The future of Selden's plan." Chapter 8. Selden's Plan. Mathematics. The synthesis of the calculus of n variables and of n-dimensional geometry is the basis of what Selden once called "My Little Algebra of Humanity," Encyclopedia Galactica. Consider a room. The location of the room is not in question at the moment. It is merely sufficient to say that in that room, more than anywhere, the second foundation existed. It was a room which, through the centuries, had been the abode of pure science, yet it had none of the gadgets with which, through millennia of association, science has come to be considered equivalent. It was a science instead, which dealt with mathematical concepts only, in a manner similar to the speculation of ancient races in the primitive prehistoric days, before technology had come to be, before man had spread beyond a single, now unknown world. For one thing, there was in that room, protected by a mental science as yet unassailable by the combined physical might of the rest of the galaxy, the prime radiant, which held in its vitals the Selden plan, complete. For another, there was a man, too, in that room, the first speaker. He was the 12th in line of the chief guardians of the plan, and his title bore no deeper significance than the fact that at the gatherings of the leaders of the Second Foundation, he spoke first. His predecessor had beaten the mule, but the wreckage of that gigantic struggle still littered the path of the plan. For 25 years, he and his administration had been trying to force a galaxy of stubborn and stupid human beings back to the path. It was a terrible task. The first speaker looked up at the opening door, even while, in the loneliness of the room, he considered his quarter century of effort, which now so slowly and inevitably approached its climax. Even while he had been so engaged, his mind had been considering the newcomer with a gentle expectation. A youth, a student, one of those who might take over, eventually. The young man stood uncertainly at the door, so that the first speaker had to walk to him and lead him in, with a friendly hand upon the shoulder. The student smiled shyly, and the first speaker responded by saying, "First, I must tell you why you are here." They faced each other now, across the desk. Neither was speaking in any way that could be recognized as such by any man in the galaxy who was not himself a member of the Second Foundation. Speech, originally, was the device whereby man learned, imperfectly, to transmit the thoughts and emotions of his mind. By setting up arbitrary sounds and combinations of sounds to represent certain mental nuances, he developed a method of communication, but one which in its clumsiness and thick-thumbed inadequacy degenerated all the delicacy of the mind into gross and guttural signaling. Down, down, the results can be followed, and all the suffering that humanity ever knew can be traced to the one fact that no man in the history of the galaxy, until Harry Selden, and very few men thereafter, could really understand one another. Every human being lived behind an impenetrable wall of choking mist, within which no other but he existed. Occasionally there were dim signals from deep within the cavern in which another man was located, so that each might grope toward the other. Yet because they did not know one another, and could not understand one another, and dared not trust one another, and felt from infancy the terrors and insecurity of that ultimate isolation, there was the hunted fear of man for man, the savage rapacity of man toward man. Feet, for tens of thousands of years, had clogged and shuffled in the mud, and held down the minds which, for an equal time, had been fit for the companionship of the stars. Grimly, man had instinctively sought to circumvent the prison bars of ordinary speech. Semantics, symbolic logic, psychoanalysis, they had all been devices whereby speech could either be refined or bypassed. Psychohistory had been the development of mental science, the final mathematicization thereof, rather, which had finally succeeded. Through the development of the mathematics necessary to understand the facts of neural physiology and the electrochemistry of the nervous system, which themselves had to be, traced down to nuclear forces, it first became possible to truly develop psychology, and through the generalization of psychological knowledge from the individual to the group, sociology was also mathematicized. The larger groups, the billions that occupied planets, the trillions that occupied sectors, the quadrillions that occupied the whole galaxy, became not simply human beings, but gigantic forces amenable to statistical treatment. So that to Harry Selden, the future became clear and inevitable, and the plan could be set up. The same basic developments of mental science that had brought about the development of the Selden plan thus made it also unnecessary for the first speaker to use words in addressing the student. Every reaction to a stimulus, however slight, was completely indicative of all the trifling changes, of all the flickering currents that went on in another's mind. The first speaker could not sense the emotional content of the students instinctively, as the mule would have been able to do, since the mule was a mutant with powers not ever likely to become completely comprehensible to any ordinary man, even a second foundationer. Rather, he deduced them as the result of intensive training. Since, however, it is inherently impossible in a society based on speech to indicate truly the method of communication of second foundationers among themselves, the whole matter will be hereafter ignored. The first speaker will be represented as speaking in ordinary fashion, and if the translation is not always entirely valid, it is at least the best that can be done under the circumstances. It will be pretended, therefore, that the first speaker did actually say, "First, I must tell you why you are here," instead of smiling, just so, and lifting a finger, exactly thus. The first speaker said, "You have studied mental science hard and well for most of your life. You have absorbed all your teachers could give you. It is time for you and a few others like yourself to begin your apprenticeship for speakerhood." Agitation from the other side of the desk. "No, now you must take this phlegmatically. You had hoped you would qualify. You had feared you would not. Actually, both hope and fear are weaknesses. You knew you would qualify, and you hesitate to admit the fact because such knowledge might stamp you as cocksure and therefore unfit." Nonsense. The most hopelessly stupid man is he who is not aware that he is wise. It is part of your qualification that you knew you would qualify. Relaxation on the other side of the desk. "Exactly. Now you feel better and your guard is down. You are fitter to concentrate and fitter to understand. Remember, to be truly effective, it is not necessary to hold the mind under a tight controlling barrier, which to the intelligent probe is as informative as a naked mentality. Rather, one should cultivate an innocence, an awareness of self, and an unself-consciousness of self, which leaves one nothing to hide. My mind is open to you. Let this be so for both of us." He went on. "It is not an easy thing to be a speaker. It is not an easy thing to be a psychohistorian in the first place. And not even the best psychohistorian need necessarily qualify to be a speaker. There is a distinction here. A speaker must not only be aware of the mathematical intricacies of the Selden plan, he must have a sympathy for it and for its ends. He must love the plan. To him it must be life and breath. More than that, it must even be as a living friend. Do you know what this is?" The first speaker's hand hovered gently over the black shining cube in the middle of the desk. It was featureless. "No, speaker, I do not." "You have heard of the prime radiant?" This? Astonishment. "You expected something more noble and awe-inspiring?" "Well, that is natural. It was created in the days of the Empire by men of Selden's time. For nearly 400 years, it has served our needs perfectly, without requiring repairs or adjustment. And fortunately so, since none of the Second Foundation is qualified to handle it in any technical fashion." He smiled gently. "Those of the First Foundation might be able to duplicate this, but they must never know, of course." He depressed a lever on his side of the desk, and the room was in darkness. But only for a moment, since with a gradually livening flush, the two long walls of the room glowed to life. First a pearly white, unrelieved, then a trace of faint darkness here and there, and finally the fine, neatly printed equations in black, with an occasional red hairline that wavered through the darker forest like a staggering rillet. "Come, my boy, step here before the wall. You will not cast a shadow. This light does not radiate from the radiant in an ordinary manner. To tell you the truth, I do not know even faintly by what medium this effect is produced. But you will not cast a shadow. I know that." They stood together in the light. Each wall was 30 feet long and 10 high. The writing was small and covered every inch. "This is not the whole plan," said the first speaker. "To get it all upon both walls, the individual equations would have to be reduced to microscopic size. But that is not necessary. What you see here represents the main portions of the plan till now. You have learned about these, have you not?" Yes, Speaker, I have. Do you recognize any portion? A slow silence. The student pointed a finger, and as he did so, the line of equations marched down the wall until the single series of functions he had thought of. One could scarcely consider the quick, generalized gesture of the finger to have been sufficiently precise, was at eye level. The first speaker laughed softly. You will find the prime radiant to be attuned to your mind. You may expect more surprises from the little gadget. What were you about to say about the equation you have chosen? It, faltered the student, is a Rigelian integral, using a planetary distribution of a bias indicating the presence of two chief economic classes on the planet, or maybe a sector, plus an unstable emotional pattern. And what does it signify? It represents the limit of tension, since we have here, he pointed, and again the equations veered, a converging series. Good, said the first speaker. And tell me, what do you think of all this? A finished work of art, is it not? Definitely. Wrong, it is not. This with sharpness. It is the first lesson you must unlearn. The Selden plan is neither complete nor correct. Instead, it is merely the best that could be done at the time. Over a dozen generations of men have pored over these equations, worked at them, taken them apart to the last decimal place and put them back together again. They've done more than that. They've watched nearly 400 years pass, and against the predictions and equations they've checked reality, and they have learned. They have learned more than Selden ever knew. And if with the accumulated knowledge of the centuries we could repeat Selden's work, we could do a better job. Is that perfectly clear to you? The student appeared a little shocked. Before you obtain your speakerhood, continued the first speaker, you yourself will have to make an original contribution to the plan. It is not such great blasphemy. Every red mark you see on the wall is the contribution of a man among us who lived since Selden. Why, he looked upward. There. The whole wall seemed to whirl down upon him. This, he said, is mine. A fine red line encircled two forking arrows and included 6 square feet of deductions along each path. Between the two were a series of equations in red. It does not, said the speaker, seem to be much. It is at a point in the plan which we will not reach yet for a time as long as that which has already passed. It is at the period of coalescence, when the second empire that is to be is in the grip of rival personalities who will threaten to pull it apart if the fight is too even, or clamp it into rigidity if the fight is too uneven. Both possibilities are considered here, followed, and the method of avoiding either indicated. Yet it is all a matter of probabilities, and a third course can exist. It is one of comparatively low likelihood, 12.64% to be exact. But even smaller chances have already come to pass, and the plan is only 40% complete. This third probability consists of a possible compromise between two or more of the conflicting personalities being considered. This, I showed, would freeze first the Second Empire into an unprofitable mold, and then eventually inflict more damage through civil wars than would have taken place had a compromise never been made in the first place. Fortunately, that could be prevented too. Then that was my contribution. If I may interrupt, Speaker, how is a change made? Through the agency of the Radiant. You will find in your own case, for instance, that your mathematics will be checked rigorously by 5 different boards, and that you will be required to defend it against a concerted and merciless attack. 2 years will then pass, and your development will be reviewed again. It has happened more than once that a seemingly perfect piece of work has uncovered its fallacies, only after an induction period of months or years. Sometimes the contributor himself discovers the flaw. If, after 2 years, another examination, not less detailed than the first, still passes it, and better still, if in the interim the young scientist has brought to light additional details, subsidiary evidence, the contribution will be added to the plan. It was the climax of my career. It will be the climax of yours. The prime radiant can be adjusted to your mind, and all corrections and additions can be made through mental rapport. There will be nothing to indicate that the correction or addition is yours. In all the history of the plan, there has been no personalization. It is rather a creation of all of us together. Do you understand? Yes, Speaker. Then enough of that. Astride to the prime radiant, and the walls were blank again, save for the ordinary room lighting region along the upper borders. Sit down here at my desk, and let me talk to you. It is enough for a psychohistorian, as such, to know his biostatistics and his neurochemical electromathematics. Some know nothing else, and are fit only to be statistical technicians. But a speaker must be able to discuss the plan without mathematics, if not the plan itself, at least its philosophy and its aims. First of all, what is the aim of the plan? Please tell me in your own words, and don't grope for fine sentiment. You won't be judged on polish and suavity, I assure you. It was the student's first chance at more than a bisyllable, and he hesitated before plunging into the expectant space cleared away for him. He said diffidently, "As a result of what I have learned, I believe that it is the intention of the plan to establish a human civilization based on an orientation entirely different from anything that ever existed before. An orientation which, according to the findings of psychohistory, could never spontaneously come into being." "Stop!" The first speaker was insistent. "You must not say never. That is a lazy slurring over of the facts. Actually, psychohistory predicts only probabilities. A particular event may be infinitesimally probable, but the probability is always greater than zero." "Yes, Speaker." "The orientation desired, if I may correct myself, then, is well known to possess no significant probability of spontaneously coming to pass." "Better. What is the orientation?" "It is that of a civilization based on mental science. In all the known history of mankind, advances have been made primarily in physical technology, in the capacity of handling the inanimate world about man. Control of self and society has been left to chance, or to the vague gropings of intuitive ethical systems based on inspiration and emotion. As a result, no culture of greater stability than of about 55% has ever existed, and these only as the result of great human misery." "And why is the orientation we speak of a non-spontaneous one?" "Because a large minority of human beings are mentally equipped to take part in the advance of physical science, and all receive the crude and visible benefits thereof. Only an insignificant minority, however, are inherently able to lead man through the greater involvements of mental science, and the benefits derived therefrom, while longer lasting, are more subtle and less apparent. Furthermore, since such an orientation would lead to the development of a benevolent dictatorship of the mentally best, virtually a higher subdivision of man, it would be resented and could not be stable without the application of a force which would depress the rest of mankind to brute level. Such a development is repugnant to us and must be avoided. What then is the solution?" "The solution is the Selden Plan. Conditions have been so arranged and so maintained that in a millennium from its beginnings, 600 years from now, a second galactic empire will have been established, in which mankind will be ready for the leadership of mental science. In that same interval, the second foundation in its development will have brought forth a group of psychologists ready to assume leadership. Or, as I have myself often thought, the first foundation supplies the physical framework of a single political unit, and the second foundation supplies the mental framework of a ready-made ruling class." "I see. Fairly adequate. Do you think that any second empire, even if formed in the time set by Selden, would do as a fulfillment of his plan?" "No, Speaker, I do not. There are several possible second empires that may be formed in the period of time stretching from 900 to 1700 years after the inception of the plan. But only one of these is the second empire. And in view of all this, why is it necessary that the existence of the second foundation be hidden, above all, from the first foundation?" The student probed for a hidden meaning to the question and failed to find it. He was troubled in his answer. "For the same reason that the details of the plan as a whole must be hidden from mankind in general. The laws of psychohistory are statistical in nature and are rendered invalid if the actions of individual men are not random in nature. If a sizable group of human beings learned of key details of the plan, their actions would be governed by that knowledge and would no longer be random in the meaning of the axioms of psychohistory. In other words, they would no longer be perfectly predictable. Your pardon, Speaker, but I feel that the answer is not satisfactory. It is well that you do. Your answer is quite incomplete. It is the second foundation itself which must be hidden, not simply the plan. The second empire is not yet formed. We have still a society which would resent a ruling class of psychologists, and which would fear its development and fight against it. Do you understand that? Yes, Speaker, I do. The point has never been stressed, don't minimize. It has never been made, in the classroom, though you should be capable of deducing it yourself. This and many other points we will make now, and in the near future, during your apprenticeship. You will see me again in a week. By that time, I would like to have comments from you as to a certain problem which I now set before you. I don't want complete and rigorous mathematical treatment. That would take a year for an expert, and not a week for you. But I do want an indication as to trends and directions. You have here a fork in the plan, at a period in time of about half a century ago. The necessary details are included. You will note that the path followed by the assumed reality diverges from all the plotted predictions, its probability being under 1%. You will estimate for how long the divergence may continue before it becomes uncorrectable. Estimate also the probable end if uncorrected, and a reasonable method of correction. The student flipped the viewer at random and looked stonily at the passages presented on the tiny built-in screen. He said, "Why this particular problem, Speaker? It obviously has significance other than purely academic." "Thank you, my boy. You are as quick as I had expected. The problem is not supposititious. Nearly half a century ago, the mule burst into galactic history, and for 10 years was the largest single fact in the universe. He was unprovided for, uncalculated for. He bent the plan seriously, but not fatally. To stop him before he did become fatal, however, we were forced to take active part against him. We revealed our existence, and infinitely worse, a portion of our power. The First Foundation has learned of us, and their actions are now predicated on that knowledge. Observe in the problem presented, here and here. Naturally, you will not speak of this to anyone." There was an appalled pause as realization seeped into the student. He said, "Then the Selden plan has failed." "Not yet. It merely may have failed. The probabilities of success are still 21.4% as of the last assessment." Chapter 9. The Conspirators. For Dr. Darrell and Peleus Anthor, the evenings passed in friendly intercourse, the days in pleasant unimportance. It might have been an ordinary visit. Dr. Darrell introduced the young man as a cousin from across space, and interest was dulled by the cliché. Somehow, however, among the small talk, a name might be mentioned. There would be an easy thoughtfulness. Dr. Darrell might say no, or he might say yes. A call on the open communiwave issued a casual invitation, "One should meet my cousin." And Arcadia's preparations proceeded in their own manner. In fact, her actions might be considered the least straightforward of all. For instance, she induced Olynthus Dam at school to donate to her a home-built, self-contained sound receiver, by methods which indicated a future for her that promised peril to all males with whom she might come into contact. To avoid details, she merely exhibited such an interest in Olynthus's self-publicized hobby. He had a home workshop. Combined with such a well-modulated transfer of this interest to Olynthus's own pudgy features, that the unfortunate youth found himself, one, discoursing at great and animated length upon the principles of the hyperwave motor, two, becoming dizzyingly aware of the great, absorbed eyes that rested so lightly upon his, and three, forcing into her willing hands his own greatest creation, the aforesaid sound receiver. Arcadia cultivated Olynthus in diminishing degree thereafter, for just long enough to remove all suspicion that the sound receiver had been the cause of the friendship. For months afterwards, Olynthus felt the memory of that short period in his life, over and over again, with the tendrils of his mind, until finally, for lack of further addition, he gave up and let it slip away. When the seventh evening came, and five men sat in the Darrell living room with food within and tobacco without, Arcadia's desk upstairs was occupied by this quite unrecognizable home product of Olynthus's ingenuity. Five men, then. Dr. Darrell, of course, with graying hair and meticulous clothing, looking somewhat older than his 42 years. Peleus Anthor, serious and quick-eyed at the moment, looking young and unsure of himself, and the three new men, Joe Turbor, Visicaster, bulky and plump-lipped, Dr. Elvit Semik, professor emeritus of physics at the university, scrawny and wrinkled, his clothes only half-filled, Homer Munn, librarian, lanky and terribly ill at ease. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.